Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Bryan v. Bay Health. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Shields? And welcome to the world of e-filing.
I'm afraid the world of e-filing is difficult for us older folks.
What?
I wasn't
it's
really
not
involved
limited.
In the initial e-filing in this case. Your Honor, this case comes before the court based on the granting of a motion for summary judgment below, which motion was based primarily on the failure to timely respond to a request for admissions. Now, that request for admissions contained two parts, the first of which indicated that a particular document was filed on June 21st, it being the attached document when there was no attached document, as indicated in the oral argument and the response below. The second, which is what I think really raises the issues here, was a question relating to the legal effect of a document filed on June 21st. It again was referred to as being attached, which it was not. A brief run over of some salient facts I think might be in order.
With respect to those facts, there was a paper filing.
There was, and I was about to go into that.
May 1st, was it?
Yes, it was.
And did that paper filing include a press release?
It did. As was indicated again in response below and in the oral argument below, it contained a press release directing immediate service. And is also contained in the response below and the oral argument. That e-filing, which occurred the very next day, the same day that it was returned by the pathontary, who decided on the next day that they wouldn't accept it, also contained a press B, as is reflected by the court's own dockets below, and in the testimony below indicates that it was the very same press B, again directing immediate service.
Do you contend that the May 1st filing was a valid filing or a defective filing?
We contend that it was sufficient to toll the statute.
All right.
Which is what the court below found and which I don't understand to be on appeal here. That is, I don't understand that argument to have been raised on appeal. That I understand this argument to be primarily whether the court's determination that an additional problem, that of the failure to respond to the request for admissions, was an adequate ground for the relief given.
All right.
Let me back up for a second, because now I'm confused. I understand the facts to be that on May 1, which was the last possible date, a complaint and a precipice was filed in a paper filing.
Correct.
And that on May 2, you were notified that that was improper because it should have been filed by e-filing.
That's correct.
So on May 2, you filed both a complaint and a precipice.
Correct.
E-filing. Then why is it that it wasn't until June 21 that another precipice was filed? And what was that all about?
That precipice was that which is provided for in the administrative rules of e-filing and is filed on paper for the benefit of the sheriff for service of process purposes. And was filed within the 120 days that rule, administrative rule, allows.
All right. Well, help me, because I am confused here. You're saying that filing the precipice with the complaint on May 2 did not set the process in motion for service of process on the defendant?
My view, frankly, is that it should. But the administrative rule also provides that a paper copy shall be filed within 120 days for the benefit of the sheriff. And I assume that the sheriff simply likes to have a paper copy which he can give someone. Not
for
me to say what the wisdom of the rules.
All right, fine. So in addition to filing an e-filed precipice with the complaint, you are required to file a paper precipice within a certain number of days.
Correct.
After filing the complaint. And you did that.
Correct.
And that filing was timely. Is that
Yes.
correct? And nobody is disputing that.
That's correct.
So what we have left, if I understand correctly, is if there is an issue as to the May 1, May 2 thing, which it's not clear to me that that is in dispute right now, that would be one potential issue, and the other issue being that summary judgment was granted on the basis of your failure to reply to a request for admissions in within the time limits.
That's correct.
Okay, and
I understand the second to be the issue before the court.
And as to that latter issue, I understand your position to be, number one, that there was nothing to admit because there was no precipice attached to the request for admissions.
Correct.
And secondly, even if it was an admission, that is, even if the request did operate as a proper request for admissions, dismissal was too stringent a sanction.
That's correct, and I would make one other argument that was raised below, and that is, even if you take primarily the second question, which asked about a legally cognizable document, as you will recall the language, being filed on June 21st, even if you accept that as a valid admission and meaningful despite the absence of the attachment, does not provide factually a basis for the determination of the court that judgment should be granted. That is, the parties can't, by agreement, change what the law is, and nor can they, by negligent failure to respond, change what the law is. If the request for admissions, for instance, had said that the statute of limitations in this case is 4 years, and it was not responded to, that would not mean that the statute of limitations was 4 years. It would still be two. We can't change what the law is by a failure to respond.
Are you arguing that another reason why the request for admissions was not legally operative is that it asked for a conclusion of law?
Yes. It asked for, rather than an underlying fact, not easily proven but not dispositive normally, what we have here is a request directed to an issue of law which is dispositive. And whether or not that's really within the confines of Rule 26 and therefore 36, I think.
Well, the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
If I understand your position correctly, the only issue or group of issues that you regard as being in contention on this appeal all cluster around the request for admission, as distinguished from the initial May 1st paper filing.
Yes. My understanding of the court's ruling below is that it found there was sufficient basis not to hold that the statute had run, but the additional problem of the failure to respond was, in its view, fatal.
Right. Well, help me understand the record, all of which appears to focus on page 6 of the opinion by the Superior Court. You seem to indicate that when you filed everything on May the 1st, it included a precipice.
Correct.
And that when you e-filed it on May the 2nd, it also included a precipice.
That's correct. And the docket entries so indicate.
But in the opinion, it says the first e-filed precipice was not on May the 2nd, but June the 21st.
That's what it says, and I think that's incorrect.
So then you're saying the Superior Court based its decision on an incorrect reading of the record.
I think that's correct. And I think it felt, or at least I'm assuming that it did, that because of the request for admission, you know, that perhaps that wasn't significant. I think it is significant. And I think it's also significant that the docket entries do not show the filing of a precipice on June 21st. And the reason they don't is there was no e-filing on that day. Had there been an e-filing, that too would have shown on the docket as a filing of a precipice on June 21st, which does not appear. And I think that is further corroboration of what the purpose of that was. It was a paper filing.
When you saw that the court issued an opinion based upon what you say is an inaccurate fact that's of record, did you do anything to point that out to the court? Did you seek re-argument, anything?
I was not involved in this case at that time. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else.
But Mr. O'Brien was in your office.
That's correct.
Is he still in your office?
Yes.
Well,
I don't offer that as an excuse. He did not.
All right. So he didn't respond to the request for admissions, which got this whole thing moving along. Do we have any indication of why he just decided to ignore the request for admission?
Well, I think as the record will indicate, it wasn't ignored but was answered late. There was a response to the request, but not a timely response.
He didn't make a timely response.
Correct.
Is there any reason in the record for that?
There is not that I'm aware of.
And then he gets an opinion from the court, apparently based on an incorrect reading of the record by the court, and he does nothing to bring that to the court's attention. Is that right?
The record does not indicate he did anything to bring that to the court's attention.
So, and you're here to save the day.
I'm doing my best.
Let me get on to a slightly different subject, which is that your argument, in part at least, is that the court's sanction was too extreme.
Correct.
And my question is this. If dismissal is one of the options available, and we were to say, you're right, this was too extreme, aren't we basically writing that out of the available action within the court's discretion? Because we'd be saying, it doesn't matter that somebody had no excuse, apparently, and missed a stated deadline. You, the trial court, are not allowed to make use of the sanctions that are listed that are available to you. At least you're not allowed to make use of all of the sanctions.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think there are obviously other circumstances under which the court might think that was the appropriate remedy. I'm merely making the much lesser statement that under the facts of this case, it is an excessive punishment for the failure. And it clearly was a failure. And I do not try to excuse that failure.
Now, is there any dispute here? And one of the reasons you said that you couldn't respond if Mr. O'Brien had focused on the response is that there was no precipice attached to
Correct.
The request for admissions. Is that undisputed?
As far as I'm aware, it is undisputed. I have not seen anything in the record that indicates a dispute on that issue.
Let's go back to May 1st momentarily. As of May 1st, there was a requirement that filing in a case like this had to be by way of e-filing. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Okay. And what was the authority for that requirement of May 1st?
I believe that the court rule directing e-filing, the administrative rule, requires it in a case where a certain amount of damages are sought, which was true here, and that's why it had to be e-filed. I understand your question properly.
Well, my question is, was there a published court rule that said that, or was it an administrative directive that, was not part of the rule?
I believe it's an administrative rule. I may stand corrected, but I believe I'm correct.
Well, was it publicly available? That is to say, did it show up in the rule books, or is that something that counsel were expected to know?
I think it was distributed. I don't recall whether it is in the rule book, and I apologize for that. But I certainly would not claim it wasn't publicly available, that you couldn't get a copy. It would seem to me that the court's questions have pretty much answered most of what I would have tried to direct my argument to. But I again would emphasize that, in my view, there is an issue with what the request for admissions is and what it isn't. That the first really is unanswerable because it's not attached, and it could be one of several things.
You're saying that the request for admission could be ignored because it wasn't an operative request?
No.
You're saying that
it
shouldn't have been ignored, but in this case it's of no consequence because, A, the request requires a response to an attachment that wasn't made, and, B, because the request was phrased in terms of legally cognizable, that rendered it not an operative or a valid Rule 36 request?
No, I think that...
Well,
I
you said that, it asked for a legal...
I'm trying to make a somewhat
you,
more...
Excuse me. You said, in response to earlier questions, that one of your arguments was, and in fact you added it as a third argument, that the request for admission sought a response to a legal conclusion rather than to a fact. But the only arguably legally conclusory language is the language that that asks for an admission that the June 21st precipice, is that the right, that was the only legally cognizable precipice.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
I think you do. I think it asks whether the only legally cognizable or the first filed legally cognizable document dealing with service of process was the June 21st document.
And that would be another reason why, even though the request for admission was improperly ignored, it doesn't matter, or it shouldn't matter.
I wouldn't say it doesn't matter. I would say it shouldn't lead to this conclusion, that is, the dismissal of the action.
Well, it shouldn't lead to the conclusion that there's a default.
That's correct. I would make that argument.
How do you read the last sentence on page 6 of the Superior Court's opinion? It says, accordingly, plaintiff's action was not commenced within the statutorily prescribed period of 2 years from the occurrence. One way to read that is to say, even if you filed your complaint, if you don't file a precipice, you've missed the statute of limitations. Is that a correct statement of the law?
Well, and in fact, I think that's what the court did say, that the precipice failure was what made it untimely, or what it viewed as the precipice failure, based on the request for admission.
Well, the only way to reconcile the first part of the decision and the second part, on the first part it says, we're going to assume that you were timely on May the 2nd because you had the paper filing on May the 1st.
Correct.
Then the second part of the opinion deals with the precipice issue. And in concluding the precipice section of the opinion, the court says you didn't commence it within 2 years, because notwithstanding the fact that the court finds you got the complaint timely filed, without a timely filed precipice, you still missed the statute of limitations. My question is that a correct statement of the law?
I think, Your Honor, that it can be under certain circumstances where there's no excuse for any delay in service. I think there is case law that when an action is filed, if the precipice, for instance, said don't serve this for another 60 days, that it would not be deemed to have been filed if that took it past the statute of limitations. I don't think that's what happened here. I think, frankly, what happened here is that the court became confused with the June 21st argument and was essentially saying in the second part of its opinion that despite the fact that there was a precipice filed on May 2nd, it was using the filing of June 21st as the operative precipice, when in fact that precipice was really simply filed for the purpose of having the sheriff serve it as is required by the administrative rule.
But I thought what you said earlier is the court was completely unaware that there was a precipice attached to the e-filing on May 2nd. Did the court ever acknowledge that?
The court, I don't see anything in the record where the court does or doesn't address the fact that a precipice was attached to the e-filing, despite the fact that it shows on the docket. And that's all I can say.
Well, it discusses it a little bit in footnote 3 on page 3, but we can read that separately. You want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for the court's attention.
Good morning, Mr. Turner.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Since we're dealing with attorney snafus, I have to bring to the court's attention one of mine. On page 4 of my answering brief, there is a list of what I contended in the brief were important dates, and 3 of them have the wrong year. So I have to confess that Mr. Shields is not alone. The middle 3 dates, I think, should obviously all read 2006 rather than 2004.
What do you think we should do about that?
I think probably I should be barred from further practice in the Supreme Court, and certainly should be barred before the automatic taping system begins, because we were discussing earlier that that's going to go into effect at some point in the future, and I was saying I may not be around any longer.
We'll take that under advisement.
Thank you.
And let you continue with your argument.
Thank you. Statutes of limitations are by their nature arbitrary, and courts and judges are necessarily approach them with some reluctance because applying a statute of limitations arguably denies a person their day in court, which is something courts don't like to do. But everybody has statutes of limitations. Delaware has them. In order to be meaningful, they have to be arbitrary. And to implement them, the courts must.
You're saying we like the jury, shouldn't be driven by sympathy.
Well, you can't be.
All right. Let's start from the beginning, May 1st. We're told by Mr. Shields that a paper precipe was filed with a complaint. Is that, you don't dispute that, do you?
I do not. And
why wasn't that effective, that is, the filing of those two documents on May 1st sufficient to toll the statute, or did it?
Because it was rejected by the court and marked void and returned.
What do we know about the e-filing the next day? We know the complaint was e-filed. How can we find out in the record whether the precipe was also e-filed on May the 2nd?
Well, I was going to explain to the court how this issue arose from my perspective after my client was served in July. And that, I think, will answer Your Honor's question, at least from what I know. My client received this complaint in July. It was forwarded promptly to me, and I looked at it, and I was puzzled because Bay Health, as a hospital, gets sued fairly frequently. The sheriff knows where to go to serve it, and they're normally served within 5 to at most 10 days after a complaint is filed. And I didn't understand why this was showing an early May civil action number and not being served until July, so I went to the pathonotary's office to find out what had happened. And what was in the pathonotary's office was an indication that there had been an improper filing on May 1st, that the complaint had been refiled on May 2nd, and there was a precipe dated June 21, a paper precipe dated June 21, which was what generated the service of process on Bay Health. I got a copy of that precipe. It was that precipe which was the subject matter of the request for admissions that we'll talk about in a second. So I filed an answer saying that the action was.
But let's go back to just being in the pathonotary's office. Let's assume, hypothetically, that they wanted to file everything on May the 2nd that had been filed on May the 1st, including the precipe. When you went to the pathonotary's office looking at the e-filing system, there should be a way to find out if, in addition to the complaint, they e-filed a precipe, shouldn't there?
The obvious intuitive answer is yes. When I looked at what they brought up on their screen, there wasn't. And all that there was in what I saw was this June 21st precipe, which was obviously what had gotten the wheels moving. And it was as a result of not seeing a timely filed precipe that I filed an answer, interrogatories, request for admission, request for production of documents.
Let me interrupt for a second. I understand your scenario of questioning why the service was so late and then going to the pathonotary and finding this paper document from June 21st and then seeking an admission on that. When it that became an issue and the parties were joined on, you know, what precipes have been filed in this case, didn't your opponent say, well, wait a second, we paper filed on May 1 both a complaint and a precipe, and we e-filed on May 2 both a complaint and a precipe, and isn't that something that either it's true or it's not true, you know, either the document is of record or it isn't. How could that be something that we're debating now?
I can only say that they didn't make that argument when the answer was filed, when the request for admissions was filed, when this motion for summary judgment, well, to continue the chronological sequence, when the plaintiffs did not respond to the request for admissions, I promptly filed a motion for summary judgment based on Russell versus Olmedo. And it was after that motion was filed that the plaintiffs filed a purported response to the request for admissions where they didn't argue that this is requesting legal conclusions and we object. They said We can't answer that because the precipice isn't attached, even though the precipice was clearly identified in the document. The precipice was a matter of public record in the Prothonotary's office, and the plaintiffs were the ones that filed that document, so they knew what we were talking about. And it's a little disingenuous, both after the motion for summary judgment was filed and now, to be claiming, well, the request for admissions didn't mean anything because the electronic filing, for whatever reason, didn't have it attached.
Well, I think that the record's pretty clear. Your opponent wasn't helpful at all to the Superior Court or to his client's case by not responding, not filing on time. But as a broader picture, let's assume that we go back to the Prothonotary now and we find that there was a precipice on May the 2nd. Would that make a difference in how we ultimately decide this case?
Well, we've never seen that precipice, and the Superior Court certainly didn't see it. All we've been provided is a docket sheet that has the word precipice on it.
My question is more philosophical, administration of justice. How is the e-filing system going to work, you know, for the benefit of the bench and the bar? And what we have is an opinion that says the first time our court ever got a precipice was June 21st. And that was your argument. That wasn't admitted. But if we do find that in the Superior Court's own documents, a precipice had been e-filed on May 2nd, should the result be different?
It depends on what it is and whether it's effective to get the judicial machinery started in motion, which is what the bright line rule is that this court has established.
What does that mean?
That means something
yeah, I mean,
happens.
You started out your brief with a quotation from Rule 3, that an action in Superior Court is commenced by the filing of a complaint and a precipice. Justice Holland is asking, suppose the record shows or we're able to ascertain without any dispute that a precipice was e-filed along with a complaint on May 2nd. What result?
Well, my first answer to that is I don't think this court should be going back and conducting an investigation ab initio when this issue was never presented to the Superior Court. I mean, this argument was not made in the Superior Court. And
well,
that
let me stop you there because I'm looking at part of the appendix where this is supposedly the transcript of oral argument. It doesn't say what oral argument, but anyhow. And it's at page 9. The court says, and what by way of precipice was filed with the e-filing, Mr. O'Brien, the same precipice that the court has an e-file of. That was e-filed on May 2nd. It's the exact same precipice that we e-filed a day later, the court. So the precipice that was filed on the 2nd, which is the e-filing precipice, was identical to the precipice filed May 1st. Mr. O'Brien, yes, if Your Honor would permit, I'd approach the bench and give you copies. The court, sure, you can just hand it up. Exhibit B, I have that, thanks. And that's the paper filing, correct.
But that wasn't the argument, the legal argument that the plaintiffs were making at that time. And my position is, you know, you've got to give the Superior Court a fair chance to decide this case. If the plaintiffs are now contending that this request for admissions was invalid for some reason, and I don't agree that a request for admissions under Rule 36 cannot ask about questions of law. I contend that they can. But the way to deal with that is to object to it and say, this isn't clear. What do you mean by legally cognizable? Or objection. This asks for a matter of law which goes beyond what Rule 36 permits. Instead, it wasn't answered. The motion was filed based on the non-response, and the Superior Court acted upon that, and there was never any attempt to ask the court below to allow a different response to be filed.
Well, but that you're certainly right on the law and the prior precedents, but we're trying to understand the basis for the ruling. And if you look at page 6 of the Superior Court's opinion, it says that the e-filed precipice wasn't filed on May 2nd, but it was filed on June the 21st. So the Superior Court is combining the failure to respond to your request for admissions with its independent understanding of the record. And for your purposes, they coincide to your benefit. But the question for us is, if notwithstanding the fact that they didn't respond to your request for admissions, the court knew for a fact there was a precipice on May the 2nd, wouldn't that factor into the relief as whether it's a dismissal or something else?
Well, I would answer that question no, based on Russell versus Olmedo, because Russell was dealing with the situation where documents were timely filed, but there was a direction to withhold service. And the bright-line rule, which this court has established and which has been there since 1971, is that what tolls the statute of limitations is an action filed with the court that starts the judicial machinery in motion. And that's a precipice that goes to the sheriff that directs service. And until that's done, there is not a tolling of the statute of limitations. That's the reason I framed the request for admissions as I did. And the Supreme Court, the Superior Court, was obligated, unless the plaintiffs came in and asked for an expansion of time or some relief from their judicial admission. But my argument to the Superior Court was that there was a binding judicial admission at that point, and that was the end of the argument.
But what's the implication of that? You know, assuming that you've quoted the holding in Russell accurately, which seems to suggest you need to get it to the sheriff in addition to getting to the prothonotary?
You need to tell the prothonotary to get it to the sheriff.
Exactly. But we now have this administrative directive or rule that says you have a separate paper filing with the sheriff that creates a gap. And are you saying that that gap basically is going to make the statute of limitations have two parts to it? So well, that even if you file your complaint on time, if you don't get the written request to the sheriff on time, you've still missed the statute.
Russell does not require the plaintiff to get anything to the sheriff. It merely requires the plaintiff to get something to the prothonotary, which starts things in motion.
Right, and your position is that there must be an e-filed complaint, an e-filed precipice, and a paper copy in order to toll the statute. I mean, isn't that at bottom what you're arguing here?
Well, I'm really arguing that this court is bound by what was presented to the Superior Court.
Okay, but please answer the question.
Okay, well, I don't know that there is an administrative directive that says a paper precipice must be filed with an electronic precipice.
You're saying the machinery, the judicial machinery, isn't invoked or started running until the prothonotary is told to deliver a process to the sheriff, who in turn, I guess, would serve it on the defendants. So there would have to be a paper copy in order to do that, would there not?
I don't know enough about electronic filing to answer that truthfully. I would guess not. If an actual precipice is filed electronically, I assume the prothonotary could print it out, but I don't know that.
So if there was a precipice filed electronically on May 2nd together with a complaint, that should be sufficient to told the statute, assuming that the statute had not already expired.
Well, again, depending on what it says. I mean, that was the problem in Russell. What it said was, don't serve this. Don't send it to the sheriff.
And well, are we going to hypothesize that it said that in order to bring it within Russell? We don't know what it says, do we?
I don't know what it says. I've never seen it. Your Honors haven't seen it. The Superior Court never saw it. And
well, my question, as a matter of precedent, and this is a hypothetical, let's assume you asked for a request for admissions that was ignored, as in this case. And based on the admission, you're entitled to summary judgment because your opponent admitted something in the record. But in my hypothetical, let's assume that what's been admitted is actually inconsistent with the record, and your opponent, who was asleep, if they would have answered and answered timely, could have said on the record, well, no. What does the court do in face of a judicial admission that, you know, lack of response that constitutes an admission that's case dispositive, even though the court can look at a record and see that's not the proper result? You seem to be suggesting if I ask you a question and you don't respond, and it's deemed to be admitted, you're out of court, even if there's a record to the contrary. Is that the way the result should work?
Well, Your Honor framed the hypotheticals to suggest an answer, and I would say—
No, I didn't, because I'm trying to understand the precedent, because when we write the opinion in this case, sooner or later we're going to find out what was filed on May the 2nd. So let's assume something was filed on May the 2nd that was a precipice. Your position is, well, doesn't matter if that was in the record and somebody could have found it, because you didn't answer the request for admission. I'm entitled to summary judgment, and that's what the adversarial system's about. You're out of court. And my question, which is not rhetorical in any way or to suggest an answer, is that the way it should work?
Well, when matters are presented to the trial court as they were in this case, it had to work this way. And that's not the trial court's fault. The trial court didn't make a mistake. I mean, there obviously were a series of mistakes made that aggravated one another. But when this motion was filed on the simple premise that the only effective precipice was dated June 21, when that was admitted by default, the summary judgment motion was filed. The plaintiff then made a contention that, well, the precipice wasn't attached, so we don't have to do anything. And when the matter came before the court, the plaintiff's answer, what the legal filing that they made, didn't raise this issue about a May 2nd filing. It came up at the oral argument. I still haven't seen this precipice, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, the Superior Court had what it had, and the plaintiffs are asking this court to go beyond what the Superior Court had to give them relief because of the snafus, frankly. And I understand the court's concern with not wanting to deny anyone their day in court. But statutes of limitations and Rule 36 have some bright lines attached to them. This court established what the bright line was in Russell, and the plaintiffs did not adhere to those. And now all they had to do in the Superior Court was go in and say, we want relief from our Rule 36 admission for the following reasons. And then there could have been an inquiry rather than having the court, this court, supposedly going and looking at the electronic docket or whatever.
But you're suggesting that based on Russell, the decision can only come out one way, and that we have to either overrule, modify, or distinguish Russell to rule in favor of Mr. Shields' client, so therefore we'd have to do this en banc.
Not exactly, Your Honor. What I'm really saying is that if the plaintiff wanted a court to rule that an electronic filing that supposedly took place on May 2nd was a legally cognizable precipice that started the judicial motion, the judicial machinery in motion, the plaintiffs should have put that before the Superior Court and allowed a record to be created about it, and they haven't done that. They didn't do it for the Superior Court, and the Superior Court acted on what it had.
Okay, so what we've got is that the plaintiffs have made a series of mistakes, the last of which is the one you've just described.
Well, actually, there are more. I don't think they're relevant.
So it seems as if our choices are to say, okay, we're going to send it back and let the trial court sort this out, because after making mistake one, two, three, four, whatever, you get even another shot at trying to clarify what's going on and what the record is or isn't. Or alternatively, where it now at least appears that the trial court based its decision on incomplete information, we should affirm because the trial court's decision was correct within the limits of what the record was.
Correct.
Okay.
One last question. What, and I asked this of Mr. Shields, and he wasn't entirely clear about the answer. The requirement for e-filing as of May 1st, what was the source of that, and was it part of the, was it in the rule book?
My understanding is that the source of it was the administrative directive that is cited in Judge Young's opinion. My understanding further is that that is not in the bound rule book, but is available in the law library.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shields?
Why should you get another chance to fix this mess?
Your Honor, because the opinion of the court below, one, relies on an incorrect fact as to when the e-filing occurred, finding that the e-filing was on June 21st when it was not.
But it was your obligation to present the record that would allow the court to make a correct determination on that point, and you didn't.
Well, certainly the record is not as clean as I would like it to be. But there is in the record a fact on the electronic docket that a Presby was in fact filed on May 2nd. There was.
Where do we see that in the appendix? Where is the electronic docket in the appendix? All right, and so just scroll your finger down and tell us where it says there's a precipe on May the 2nd.
The very first line where it says precipe and complaint, precipe over on the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side is the date of May 2nd. So that indicates, I would suggest, Your Honor, that a complaint and a precipe were filed along with the other documents on that date, May 2nd.
Page number?
This is the first page attached to the appendix of the appellant and is the electronic docket from
the
state.
What is the page number of the appendix?
A1.
A1.
It doesn't have page numbers on it.
Yeah, it was just attached, and I'm sorry.
Right. It should have been Shields, A1. We used up your time with those questions. As you can see, this oral argument is being taped, and the court would like you to make certain that Mr. O'Brien reads the briefs that were filed in this appeal and views the tape of this oral argument.
Very well, sir.
Thank you. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll take a brief recess.